Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
To inform, inspire, and empower Alcoholics Anonymous sponsorship locally and internationally to be their very best, both personally and spiritually. This is the mission of RumRadio.org, an internet radio program dedicated to carrying the message of recovery to a world plagued by alcoholism and addiction. Alcoholism and addiction is the number one health issue in our world today, and RumRadio.org is actively participating in the solution. Interviews with a plethora of people sharing their experience, strength, and hope. Live Sundays at 9 p.m. Central Time and rewound again on Saturday and Monday. Tune into 12-Stepology at its best on RumRadio.org.
Hey, bravo.
Well, doesn't want to play. I don't get it. Okay. Yay! We usually have an applause daily go, but I guess Mom couldn't make it tonight. Usually it's my mom out there in the audience. Oh, here she comes.
Your mom dozed off for a second.
She came running in. She was just so excited. She got tied up talking to somebody out in the parking lot. But she always makes it. For some reason, Mom always seems to make it. Welcome and hello. This is Joseph G. with Rum Radio and RumRadio.org, the most comprehensive 12-step sponsorship in the known and the unknown universe. And I'll be saying this for a little while. The unknown universe has closed in a little bit. The GSO, that's not the KGB, but the GSO, which is the General Service Organization of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the auspices of the Grapevine, which is our monthly magazine in print, it's our meeting in print, has produced a sponsorship book. It's called One-on-One Sponsorship. It's the first time in 78 years that this organization produced this information. So evidently, sponsorship is coming to the forefront of the recovery community. I'd like to acknowledge WNAH, that's Hoyt Carter and Tony the Horse, who affords us the opportunity to broadcast live to their listening audience in Nashville, parts of Kentucky, and Alabama. And they do this for us as a public service presentation. Thanks, guys. It really helps. We would also like to acknowledge RecoveryToday.net magazine. It's one of the finer recovery journals, and they afford us some print space from time to time. So it gets the word out a little bit more. We've been befriended on Facebook by the GSO in India. So it looks like we got the subcontinent going. I don't know how important that's going to be, if that's going to be have any impact at all. We hope so. I know in India they have a difficult time with the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction. It's a tough go. Nobody really knows why they're having a harder time over there. I think it's because of the polytheism, although which fits into the basic template of AA, which anybody can believe in anything at any given time, especially in the beginning. So for some reason, though, they're having difficulties matching that. And I'm hoping Rum Radio will have a positive impact on their understanding of recovery and sobriety. I gratefully like to introduce my co-host. That's Harold B. He's a family intervention specialist. He does a fine work with troubled families, and I believe as the families are the basic unit of our society. As in a family goes, so does the nation, so does the country, and so does the world. Today, most of the problems we have socially are directed because of children growing up without being taught correct principles. They're growing up like vacant lot weed children, latchkey kids. No one was there to teach them anything. No one was there And so they join the gangs and the clubs, and that's how they learn what life looks like. And, of course, drugs and alcohol, tremendous amount of peer pressure at that age, especially when there's nobody home other than other kids to teach them. Harold also goes to the prisons. And in the prisons, we find that most of the problem in the prisons, people there, are crimes of opportunity fueled by drugs and alcohol. Now, we have some career criminals. They, you know, they're horse thieves looking for a free ride, and they'll always be with us. But the vast majority of folks in those prisons are about drugs and alcohol. It is an epidemic. We've connected up with a group called the Anonymous People. They're doing a movie, and they're going to be showing it all over the country. It's about anonymity and some of the people that are coming out saying that they're in the program. Now, this does not go along with AA. You know, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all the traditions in AA, which means that there's a spiritual connection between anonymity and recovery. So there's a question about that, but we'll see how that plays out. To remind you that this is not AA. This is not NA. This is not CA. This is Rum Radio. We're closer to Paranoids Anonymous. No, but that's where nobody will tell you where they hold the meetings. And if you can make for the whole hour, you might really think that we're Narcoleptics Anonymous. So I think you're going to enjoy the show tonight. So I want to introduce you to my co-host, Harold B. Harold, say hello.
Hello, everybody. I appreciate that introduction, Joseph. And I just want to remind our listeners that this is not a money-making proposition either. Joseph does not make a dime from our efforts. In fact, he's sent thousands of dollars into the website, which is rumradio.org, and the radio program, where we focus on working with others. And I appreciate the introduction and the mention about families and about kids. I work with families a lot, and I do go to the Fort Bend County Jail. They've had some budget cuts, and they're making things a little more difficult, changing things around again. So they want a new focus on anger management, but the programs that we teach cover that in addition to other things. The answer is really a closer, conscious contact with God. And I just wanted to mention that I did an intervention on Sunday afternoon and evening.
Hi, Joseph.
It took several hours, 10
radio.
Hours, but
it
was successful. And for those of you out there who have a family member who's drinking and they need some help, they don't really recognize that they have a problem or they think they have it under control, that's an ideal opportunity for an intervention. You need to get everyone around who can be tough, use tough love. You need to write a letter. Each one of you needs to write a letter. And then you go to a meeting with the person with the problem.
Windows says something.
It's a surprise to them, but you ask them to listen. You tell them how much you love them. All very, very positive, and you ask them to get help. And then at the end, you do get tough, and you explain what you're going to have to do to take care of yourself if they can't get help. I will take that out online and put it on the chat room tonight so that it's a five-part letter that you have to write, and so I explain that in detail. I'll give that to you folks in case you want to do your own intervention. They're not exactly like the ones they show on TV. Those are done for entertainment purposes. These are done to save a life. These problems are like death, folks, and we work together and use really good teamwork so that we can help a person see just how serious this problem is so they can take some steps before it's too late. The chat room is open, and you can find that by going to rumradio.org. Click in the upper right corner where it says live. You'll go to the Rum Radio website, and there you can find the chat room on the right side of the page. also a couple of guests in the chat room, so I'm going to post that outline for the invention letter for now, and let's go forward with the program. Joseph?
Thanks, Harold. Yeah, thank you. The call-in number, if you'd like to call in, is 949-534-0621. Again, 949-534-0621. And in New Jersey, it's 949-5... Okay, oh, you got it already. Okay, well, I usually like to start the show before we introduce our host, and we're our guest, rather. Oh, I'm the host. Let me introduce myself. I'm a man of wealth and taste. Not much. We like to start the show off with the third step prayer that's found in the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous on page 63. I like to use the information from the basic text because the all 12-step recovery programs come from the understanding in the basic text. All 12 steps come from the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, you use NA, CA, like I said, Paranoids Anonymous, ART, you name it. There's a 12-step program that addresses any kind of falling away of a spiritual nature. But the original, the template, the mother of all 12 steps is in the big book. I like to use the basic information because everything else derives from that. So it's on page 63. Usually the way it works with me when I get a new prospect, the big book tells us, go find a prospect and start working on him. They back then when they wrote the book, they didn't expect people who didn't know anything to come and get a sponsor or the jargon. We do today. I don't know why, but we just happened to come to that agreement. But it used to be go find the prospect and start working on them. So we used to do that, and I do that because that's what the big book says. Now I have some people come up to me and they want me to sponsor them, the real foolhardy types. But usually what happens after a fellow's gotten a beginner's chip, which is an outward sign of an inward commitment to try our way of life for 24 hours. They're the color of handcuffs. It's a little aluminum disc, and on one side it has the triangle, the three-sided triangle, and it also says, to thine own self be true, and it's a outward sign that they're going to try our way of life, not to drink or drug for 24 hours. Just 24, one day at a time. Let's see if you can do it. Some do, some don't, but at least at that point, they're desperate enough and they're in enough pain to try it. Give it a try. It's willingness. That's all the requirement is coming in, is to be willing, even willing to be willing. Willingness is like the mustard seed. If it's a good seed planted in the heart, it will grow. The problem with willingness is that it takes a little discipline. The problem with discipline, it takes a little motivation. The problem with motivation is not now becomes mañana. So this is, they've walked up. They took their walk, and I grabbed the guy after. We have a prayer at the end, usually some kind of chant, third step prayer, or we have the Serenity Prayer. We have the Our Father in a lot of places. We're in the Bible Belt here in Houston, so we do the Our Father most often. And right after that, I grab the guy, the new guy who just got his chip, and I ask him, have you had enough? If he's had enough, he knows what I'm talking about. If he isn't quite sure, he'll ask me, what do you mean? Well, have you had enough pain? Had you had enough humiliation? Have you had enough alcohol? Have you had enough? Yes or no? Yes. Are you willing to go to any length to achieve sobriety? Yes or no? Yes. I tell them at that point, you can get well from this disease of mind, body, and spirit, but there's certain things you have to do. And I usually carry around Clancy's 7 questions. I have them on the website. It's under the sponsorship tab, how to find a sponsee. Print them out. It's all in Word. Good little 7 questions. Doesn't replace a 4-step or anything else. It's just a good way to kickstart this thing. I found it to be very productive. I carry it with me because I believe that luck is no more when preparation meets opportunity. Be prepared. The opportunity will manifest itself. I give them this, and I say, okay, I need you to answer these 7 questions, and I need them back tomorrow. You got to remember now, they're still a prospect. They're not a sponsee. If I get them back the next day, they're ready to go. Okay, they've taken simple instruction, and they've demonstrated a willingness to go to any length. So I'm good with that, and they become a sponsee. And one of the first instructions I give them is, okay, we give them suggestions, which is a subtle command, but they're still just suggestions. Let me remind you that recovery, the cornerstone of recovery is agency or free will. Nobody tells you what to do. We make suggestions. Some might be firm suggestions in the beginning, like don't drink, go to meetings, read the big book, start working the steps. But if they refuse to do any of that, that's not my business. My business is to direct them to make a conscious contact with their creator, which we find is to be a spiritual malady, physical malady, and a mental disorder. So I'm sure our guest coming up will give a little bit more on that. The first suggestion is find a home group, because in the home group he needs names. I need names of men. 20, 30 names would be great, but as many as you can get. I need their names and their phone numbers and that they've agreed to make phone calls. You usually get in a beginner's packet, or you get there a little early and have the chairperson send out a piece of paper and the men can put their names. I believe men with men and women with women, it's easier to identify with the same gender. 1, 2, sponsorship is a very intimate relationship which could be easily misconstrued. You got enough problems going on. Why throw another hoop into the deal? But if it works out that it doesn't work out with the same gender, you know what? You work the steps. That's the key. You work the steps. If it doesn't work out with that sponsor, you can always get another sponsor. All sponsorship is temporary. It's either temporary for a day or temporary for a lifetime, or anywhere in between. The key to this thing is the sponsor helping you get through the steps, and the reason why that help is to direct you to a higher power. We call it Hewlett-Packard. Some people take Hewlett-Packard as a higher power, HP. And whatever you decide what that might look like, anything more than you, it has to be a little, even if it's a tower's height or a head and shoulder, there's got to be some power greater than you that's going to help you relieve you from your addiction. And once you've accomplished that, you get the men's names. First thing I want you to do is I want you to call these men every day. Now, it's a lifeline. Your sponsor's not always going to be available. The telephone calls, especially in the beginning, you'll have questions. You'll be in bad spots. Night comes. Night draws out like a blade sometimes. You don't know where to go, what to do. So now you have a lifeline list. They'll get to know your name, that you get to know their name. That's 1. 2, get them used to picking up the 500-pound telephone and asking for help. Ooh, that's tough sometimes. It also, the third step prayer is also called the surrender prayer. It also encapsulates what we're going to try to accomplish by working all 12 steps. And fourthly, the person he might be calling might have been thinking about taking his first drink, his first hit of crack, his first. And he probably will not. It puts everybody in a higher spiritual plane. Your sponsee's already in service, which we found to be one of the biggest immunities. One immunity we have from alcohol is intensive work with another alcoholic. This activity works when other activities fail. We found this to be true, and we found it to be true in the last 78 years. So it's true then, it was true in the middle, and it's still true today. So we find that to be service to be the key to this thing. And this is the third step prayer. God, I offer myself to thee, to build with me and do with me as thy wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Can I get an amen on that?
Amen. Amen.
Thank you, Harold. Thank you. Amen. Well, I want to introduce our interview for tonight. I think you're going to like this guy. I like this guy. He was in my home group. If we ever have – our home group keeps losing its perch. It's one of those magic home groups that a lot of kids go in there, a lot of smokers, and the smoking ban always seems to follow it around. It's a primary purpose group out of Houston, great little group. But right now we're orphans again. So this is Rafe S. Rafe has got a great story he's going to tell us. Rafe is a big book thumper. I call him the big book man. If you want to know something in that big book and how it relates to sobriety, you go ask Rafe. Rafe knows. Rafe, how you doing tonight?
I'm doing well, Joseph. Thank you for having me on your show.
You're quite welcome. The way we usually do this is that we like to get your story that we call in the program, what it was like, what happened, and what it's like now, and what keeps you in maximum service to God and your fellows. So when was the first time you realized that drugs and alcohol were your was your key to paradise?
Do what now? Do you ask me when?
Yeah, when? When did you first say, hey, man, this is good stuff?
Probably 13 years old was when I got drunk the first time and I smoked weed for the first time. And I just kind of, this was what I wanted to do. My grades fell, my athletics never fell, but because that was always my ticket. But I knew there was something there that I wanted. It made me feel different. It got me away from myself. And life was good when I was on that. What's the little cliche they got? It's a drug deficiency, that's what I had. I had a drug deficiency when I got here, an alcohol deficiency, and I tried to keep it going.
So 13, so what did you do? Now, that's junior high, I think. Isn't that junior high school?
It was in eighth grade.
Eighth grade, yeah.
Yeah, I'm part of the band that this is my second. I've got 15 and a half years sober right now. But when I start my story from the podium in the club, I'm fond of saying that this is the second time that I've had continuous, uninterrupted, double-digit sobriety. What messed it up the first time was getting into the eighth grade.
It's funny. Getting into the eighth grade.
That was what messed up my sobriety then, yeah.
So tell me, okay, so you're in the eighth grade, in the ninth grade, you get bounced out of school. Your grades were suffering, I take it. Some no, but...
Yeah, I didn't really care about the grades. As long as I could make a D or a C, it didn't matter. I had the brain potential to do really, really well. I've got records in elementary school of doing really, really well. And the reason that I kept the D and kept the D's and C's and did minimum was because I liked playing baseball, I liked playing football, and I liked boxing. My dad was a boxing coach and always had a gym available. Baseball, I was quite well at all the sports. I have tremendous eye-hand coordination. I'm 52 years old, and I'm still a pretty good athlete. And that was my deal, was to be able to stay on those different fields or in the ring.
So even though you're drinking and drugging, the sports are still okay. Did you feel that it enhanced your sports?
No, absolutely not. I knew not to smoke pot or drink before I went to baseball practice or went to the gym to train for boxing. I knew not to do that, and I didn't. When we didn't box year-round and we didn't play baseball year-round, it was seasonal. And generally, when it was baseball season, I just didn't do the drugs and the alcohol, or not as much. Maybe it might be on the weekends and not on the game day. Definitely not on game days, not on the fight night. They were always hindrances to me, and I recognized way back then, even though I had no conception of what alcoholism was or drug addiction, I knew that I couldn't have a peak performance if I was under the influence. But I loved being under the influence. I'm kind of an adrenaline freak, and that's good. So then
high school, all through high school, then you're still drinking and drugging in high school. And your your dad's a coach. Now, did he get the drift of this and all? Did he see something going on, or did he notice?
I don't think so. I know what it feels like to be the single greatest creation on the face of the earth, and that's what I was to my father. This guy lived through me. He loved me. He tolerated me when I was really messing up, and there was times that I did. When I was 15 years old, I got busted with some guys in 10th grade in a car. We were smoking weed during school, and I remember I got home, and Palmer Jogarby's program had just started right around and then. I know now. I didn't know that then, but my mother told me, she came to me and said, honey, there's this drug program. It's Palmer Drug Abuse Program. Do you have a problem? And I said, no. And that was the end of it. We didn't have the knowledge back. That's 1977. We didn't have the knowledge then that we have now. I live in the age now, as do you, and I know you recognize this, that I live in the age where Bill Wilson's dream is exemplified and personified in our society through the saturation of 12-step programs everywhere. I know kids right now, Joseph, that are 15 and 16 years old that have 1, 2, even 3 years sobriety and go to meetings regularly, go to the sober high school downtown, and I'm just so blessed to be able to see Bill Wilson's dream that he had back in 1939 when the book was published. I think he was about 46 then. He had like 4 years sober. I live in the age where his dream has completely come true. And I have the awareness and the big book knowledge to be able to see that. And it's such a thrill to me sometimes. There's quite a few people that go to Primary Purpose. They come in little groups. They come from Cornerstone. I think that's the name of the high school. These are kids. 15 years old and they've got a year sober. 21 years old and they've got 3 years sober. And we've got a bunch of young people like that. And it thrills me to death that I get to see Bill Wilson's vision.
Let's back up a little bit. Okay, so you're in high school and you're doing the thing. Your dad is vicariously living through you, so he sees you as a success. I think it's because what I've seen is that parents are going to relive their glory days through their children. You see that. And they can do no wrong. And, yeah, so you're the golden kid. So now you all through high school, same deal. This just kind of played out.
Yeah, during this time, I won 4 batting trophies in Little League, Tony League, Kurt League. Also, I was the top hitter in American Legion baseball. After I got out of high school, I was the top hitter in Palomino and Thoroughbred League. I played on 2 junior college World Series championship teams at San Jack. Roger Clemens was our first baseman my last year. I also won 4 Golden Glove titles. In Houston, I won 1 state Golden Glove title. I fought in the Nationals that year and got to the runner-up. So I'm an athlete. That's what I do. And I can't not perform, but I needed to know. I needed to blow off steam. I needed to be celebrated. And when you get to the level that I got to later as a professional, everything kind of becomes available to you because people want to make you happy. They want to give you stuff. And I know that feeling. That's why people want their autograph, and they want to give them this and give them that. And you've got girls that want to run around and do things with these guys because they're famous. And I wasn't famous in that era, but I was famous around the people that I ran around with and in high school. So that was always my ticket. The cops let me go with speeding tickets. They let me go with bikes. They let me go with everything because I was Ray Sims, and he's a jock, and he's successful, and he's a Gold Glove champ, and he's a batting champ. So all that stuff played in to the little design that got me to where I'm at right now. And
so when you did marijuana, did you do anything else? Were you doing any of the speed?
Shot a whole bunch of methamphetamine my senior year in high school. I loved acid. I remember seeing a reel-to-reel film in Mr. Hyde's class when I was in the 6th grade at MacArthur Elementary, and it said that if you took 300 hits of acid, you would be considered mentally incompetent. So I stopped counting at 200 hits. Do the math on that. I know, it was crazy. It was just little stuff like that.
It's funny you should say that. I had a buddy of mine that did that one time, and he said he took so much acid that he believed that he lost his mind. And I asked him, I said, well, what did you do? He says, I kept taking some more just to make sure.
See, I relate to that. Yeah.
So when you did the drugs, was that sort of like this was like you was like an attaboy, like this was like you got a title, you won a trophy, and you were taking drugs in sort of as a reward. Was that your reward system?
Yeah, it was. I don't know. Looking back, I don't really understand what was going through my brain. I know it was a paradox. If looking back now, it's a complete paradox in the fact that I was a jock. A real hardcore jock, but I like to run around with the stoners and the drunks and the good old boys, you know, and do what they did. I guess mainly it was a lot of it had to do with the back padding. Way to go, man. That's him over there, you know, that kind of stuff. These guys were always willing to throw kudos at me and adulation on me, and it was cool. It fed my little fragile ego, you know, and it felt good. And so, but in order to do that, I had to do this stuff with them, and that's what I did.
Now, okay, so now how about college? You go to college?
Did a little bit there at San Jack, had a blast. I was pretty well cleaned up. I had a wife and a couple of little kids. I was working on doing the scholarship deal. I was so busy. It was just, and I knew possibly, potentially, that going to college and playing baseball could potentially maybe get me into the AAA ball or maybe the big show, you know, major league. And I knew that. I stopped smoking pot. I was 18 or 19, I think. I just got tired of it. It was like I felt like I was a daily smoker, but I would get high, get really stoned, get paranoid, didn't want to talk. I'd want to eat, maybe have sex, and go to bed. And that's what I did. And it just became a real monotonous routine that I didn't like, especially the paranoia part. So I stopped smoking pot, but the alcohol was always there, sometimes in moderation, sometimes to complete stupor, blackout, drunkenness. But the alcohol never left. That was always there. And I love Jack Daniel's whiskey. I promise I do.
That's talking whiskey.
Man, I love me some whiskey.
Especially you said, okay, so now you had children too, right? You got a wife, got a couple kitties.
Right, right. That was the high school sweetheart. I was kind of coerced and pushed into this marriage with this girl that had my first son. He was 4 months when we got married. And I had my dad telling me do the right thing, marry this girl, this little boy needs a dad. And I'm like, Pop, can I have a dad anyway? I'm always going to be a thing. Yeah, but you need to do the right thing. And my mom, she's real Bible Belt lady, Church of Christ. You got to do this, you got to do that. It's in the scripture, but and there's some rightness to all that, and I understand what you said, but I was not prepared for what was coming. I was young, and I didn't want to do it, but I just basically got pushed and shoved and handcuffed into this marriage, and I wasn't happy about it.
And the drinking and drugging was just a regular what you
did? They were there. The drugging pretty much stopped. My mom kind of slipped a few years ago and told me that the last 6 months while I was in her stomach, the last 6 months of her 9-month gestation period, that she was prescribed amphetamines by her doctor. Now, this is in 1961. She said that it was prescribed by the doctor to induce and produce a low birth weight in me, which would make an easy delivery because the mortality rate was high. That's what she said. But I also know my mom's vanity. She's vain, 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 and that's where I get that from, too, by the way. I was born at 6 pounds, 4 ounces. My brother and my sister were both well over 10 pounds. So I was essentially born, she didn't take amphetamines with them, obviously. I was born half of their birth weight. The weed, the Quaaludes and the Mandrax and everything that was around back then, the down drugs didn't do anything for me. And I remember the first time that I did meth. I remember the very first time that I snorted cocaine, the very first time that I smoked cocaine. These were the ones that I was attracted to, the upper drugs, not the downer drugs. And it's kind of another one of those paradox, an ironic paradox, that alcohol was always the beginning and the end. You know, Jack, it always started and ended with Jack Daniel's whiskey. That was just what I needed to get me going and keep me going. And the other stuff was in the middle.
All right. So how long did this routine kept going? You didn't finish college. All of a sudden you left college. You left college,
yeah,
got a job.
Yeah. I got hurt on the waterfront. I left St. Jack when I was 20, I think. I got a job on the waterfront. I got hurt. Ruined my back. I got crushed between two cargo containers. I had the wife, the kids, and I had, what do you call it? It was a chymopipine injection. It dissolved the disc and it grew back. It took 14 months for me to heal. I hadn't boxed since I was 19. I hadn't played baseball since I was 19. I was mad at my dad, and that's the reason I stopped boxing. I wanted to take over until I was 19, and we got in an argument, and I quit. I'll show you, Pop. At 21, he, at the end of this recuperation period, this 14 months in this MAC procedure, he started taking me on the other side of Houston to watch these guys that I had beat and knocked out as amateurs, as young pros, getting all this fame and adulation. Essentially, we just fanning the flames to get me back while I was still a young man. And I really didn't want to do it. But Dale Brumley, who was a friend of my dad's, and he's still a friend of mine to this day, he's about 10 years older than me. He sat me down one day, and right around this time, and he said, Rafe, he said, man, why don't you get back in the ring? And I said, man, I just don't want to, Daryl, the boxing ring. I said, I just don't want to. I had already had 181 amateur fights. I had won every major title that you could win. I was, in the amateur circles, I was quote-unquote famous, and I loved that, but I didn't want to do it. It's hard work. Bill Pacific took me to lunch, and he said, look, go ahead and try it. Do it. Throw your hat in the ring and get in the ring and do it. Do the best you can for 5 or 10 years because I promise you, you don't want to get my age. He was almost 40. You do not want to get my age and look back and say, wow, I could have been this and I could have done that. Why didn't I do that? So he kind of coerced me with that a little bit of guilt to get it back in the ring. And I started going back into the ring. And in August 83, which is 30 years ago this month, I had my first pro fight against, what was his name? Willie Dahl. He was a former two-time state gold glove champion. Knocked me down the first 20 seconds of the first round. It was a mess, too. I ended up winning the fight. It was a four-round fight. I don't want to. I got $150 for that. I was 22 years old. And I realized that if I drank or I drug, I wouldn't be able to do anything. There was absolutely no drug. None, zero, zero, nada. For the next few years, the only time I drank was in the recoup period in between fights. Immediately after the fight, I would take 3 to 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 days off out of the gym. And I would pull a drunk or two, go out with the guys and celebrate the guy that I just knocked out, blah, blah, blah. And that's how that stayed until this. I hadn't thought about these dates in a while. You still there, Joseph?
I'm here.
Okay. In December 85, I was 13-0 as a professional. There were a lot of heads being turned because I was a white kid that could fight. I don't mean any racial ramification, that's just how it was, and that's still how it is. And there was a guy that had made good out of my little hometown on the east side. I'm not going to say his name. He had made a whole bunch of money, and he wanted to meet me. And the guy that was going to introduce us asked me if I had ever heard of freebase cocaine. I was like, and I'm from the old Richard Pryor generation where it was glamorized. I never heard the bad stuff. We didn't hear the bad stuff. All we heard was the good stuff, the glamour and the fame and the exhilaration and how it was supposed to be all this. And I was like, dude, yes, I would love to try that. So we got over to this guy's house, and I remember blowing out the very first hit of cocaine I had been drinking that night, too. The very first hit of cocaine I blew out, within 15 seconds, I remember thinking, this is the drug that I've been looking for my whole life. I want to do this for the rest of my life. And,
yeah, I mean,
huh?
What was that, Harold?
Yes, me too. That first moment, that first cocaine, you know that you've arrived in heaven.
Yeah, it's a full body wash, a full body orgasm. That's what I explained it. I was trying to explain it to my then wife, and she went ahead and tried it. And she goes, I don't know what you're talking about. It didn't do anything for her. She's not an alcoholic. She's a girl that's 17 years old. I got her really drunk. She told me she would never drink again. She's 54 now, and she's never done it again. She's never even taken a drink since. So she took one hit of cocaine later on. She was like, what's the big deal? I don't like it. I don't want to do it no more. It tastes nasty. And so she did. She became a staunch enemy about that stuff. Anyway, go ahead.
So, okay, so... Okay. Yeah, so you took the coke, you did the free basing. I remember the free basing, that was before crack. That's what we called crack before it became crack. It was pre-crack. It was, right. you, you'd boil up your own Coke with baking soda and make your rock and then do the deal. And it was very laborious and was a very ritual-based drug.
Yes,
not much. Not much talking would go on. It would just be on and on, hour after hour, and hour, day after day. Sometimes people would just go on and on and on and never stop. People would be doing it in the shower because they were sweating so much. They'd been on it, too, for 3 or 4 days. I mean, it was just quite the drug. Personally, I didn't get off on it because it was so quiet. You know, I'm a talker. I'm a party guy, you know, so that didn't work for me.
Right.
All right. So you found freebasing. Now what? Now where are you going from there? Now you're
Wait a
doing
minute.
It more.
I've got my timeline mixed up. I'm sorry. This was in December 85, not 84. I was 18 and 0. I had been in the. I was rated in the top 10 in the world. There was some acclaim and some notice, and I was starting to pop up in Ring magazine. And I took this first jump into cocaine 3 months before my first title fight, my world title fight against Dwight Crockett. He's still in the news, and they came from Dewey, Indiana, and they just moved down here and they stayed forever. He trains fighters now. He has a gym downtown, but I knew that after about, I don't know, a month and a half or 2 months of chasing this stuff, and that's exactly what I did. I started. Everything started suffering when I would go to the gym. My home life was suffering. My kids were saying, where's our daddy? You know, everything started suffering immediately, and I'm still a long way from crossing over the line. And I realized that if I didn't stop, this had the potential to become really, really badly or end up really, really badly. I didn't know anything about the consequences then. I didn't know anything about the potential for death. I didn't know anything about the potential to become homeless or any of that stuff. I'm just a kid. I'm 24 years old, 25 years old. I had no idea about any of that stuff. I'm still years away from the program. You know, in the 12 and 12, Bill Wilson, at the end of the first step, he says, under the lash of alcoholism, we are driven to AA, and there we discover the fatal nature of our situation. That there, of course, is Alcoholics Anonymous. No one ever, ever, ever even hinted that there was... some really bad things that can happen for this. I knew maybe it wasn't moral. I knew that it was cocaine and it was frowned upon. I knew it was against the law. I knew it was a felony. And I knew there was a reason it was like that, but I didn't have any of the information that I have now that has been that I gleaned from Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I say Alcoholics Anonymous, I mean Cocaine Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous, just even Paranoid Anonymous, even though we don't know where they're at. I didn't know any of this stuff. But I was still young enough and hadn't crossed over that line yet. I knew that it was going to interfere with everything in my life. I was just obsessed with it, and somehow, some way, I backed off 2 months before that. In March '86 is when I had that fight. I backed off 2 months before, and I threw myself back into.
How much did you weigh at that time?
My fighting weight was 130 pounds. That's junior lightweight or super featherweight, depending on which jurisdictional body that you use, the WBA or the WBC. The WBC is junior lightweight, but the WBA, which is the Boxing Association, that's the super featherweight and junior lightweight.
I see.
It's 130 pounds max.
All right.
So I was a little guy. I'm 5'6". I'm still 5'6". I weigh about 165 right now. And it's a whole different game now. Back then, I realized that something was going to happen. And I stopped, and I earned another world title fight in 87. I lost both of those. The last I got in the world ratings was number 2. And there's a lot of kudos that are thrown at you. Everywhere I go, people knew me. Learjet, limos, autographs, TV. Josephine Abercrombie held my contract for 3 years. It's the Abercrombie that everybody's thinking of. She owned Camphor & Ironworks, Old Money, and her dad founded the medical center here in Houston, Texas. That's all his handiwork. Old blue blood money. She's the one that had my contract. In 87, I had my last fight in Miami against Mario Miranda. That fight is on YouTube, by the way. Anybody interested, just type in my name, R-A-P-H-E-Sims. And I lost by a small margin. I know for a fact that I won at least 10 of the 12 rounds handily. It was one of those classic hometown decisions that you hear about. He was from Columbia, but that I relocated to Miami, and there was a big, giant Colombian following there in the stands. The promoter was Colombian. Jose Salomon, who's the president of the WBC, was there. He's Colombian. Y'all can do all the math. I approached two judges before then, Spider-Man and Dickie Cole, and I asked them if there was a fix on the fights, and they both assured me there wasn't. Well, they lied. I won at least 10 of the 12 rounds. They started listing scorecards. I remember looking at Jesse Reed, my trainer, one of my trainers. My dad wasn't there that night. And he started saying that they're fixing to screw us. They're fixing to screw us. He's hollering it across the ring. I'm looking at him with complete incredulousness in my face, hearing these scorecards being announced. Alexis Arguello hopped in the ring, took off his headphones. He was one of the color commentators for Central America in Mexico, and hopped up and said, "Everybody's going to know that this is a horrible decision." I'm like, "Thanks, dude, but it's not going to matter now, you know? It's already done. It's in concrete." That was one of Ring Magazine's worst decisions of the year. It wasn't the worst decision of that year, but it was on that list. Everybody knew it. And I walked away from boxing. I never looked back. I worked 13 years to get to that position, and it all turned out to be about money, man.
It's always about money. All right, so now I'll say you lost that, and now what happened? How we get down onto the – how did you get into AA?
I went to work for Arco Chemical. I was kind of a shoe-in. A friend of mine's dad was a superintendent out there. It's the good old boy, Blue Car Systems, named the Dirty Pool, Hiram Pool. He's passed away a couple of years ago. I went to him asking for a job. 2 weeks later, I'm working – making, I forgot what it was, $17, $18 an hour, something like that. Maybe not that much, but it was one of those retirement jobs. It's the dream job that everybody wants over there. And I got that job. I did very well in that particular deal. It's a lot of memorization. You got to know about the processes. You monitor levels, pressures, temperatures, flows. The good old boy system in there. Everybody drank, which was good. We worked 4 days on, 4 days off. Cocaine was going out of the system. I was doing very well at that job. My first year and a half, I think it was almost 2 years that I had been there, excelling, memorizing these manuals, knowing what's going on, catching attention. And on July 5th, 1990, they had a waste hydrocarbon tank out there. I was in the field. I was probably 100 to 150 yards from it. 11:21 that night, it popped. When I say popped, it means there was a horrible explosion. There was 248, I think that's the number, gallons of waste hydrocarbons in this tank. Hydrocarbons are gasoline, naphtha, oil, diesel fuel. Those are all hydrocarbons. They popped, and we knew there was going to be some deaths. I knew that. It knocked me down. I don't remember. It feels like in my memory now that I got knocked maybe 20 or 30 feet in the air, but I do know that I got slammed on the ground with my head in the dirt, looking up, seeing this giant orange mushroom cloud. Turns out there weren't three or four people like there should have been. There were 17 men in there. The crew, there had been, most of the men were on a crew that should have been sent home at 11 o'clock, 11 p.m. that night, because that was their 16th hour. And that was a real, real no-no in the chemical plant to keep somebody over 16 hours. This is our maintenance crew, and all these guys were just wasted. They were all found at the base of this tank, completely incinerated. If you've never seen burn beyond recognition, I hope no one ever has to see. Their bodies had gotten so hot that they had swelled up and popped with their entrails all over the place. I remember looking at some of those faces trying to figure out who this was. I was in complete total shock. I was 28 years old, and I knew that something significant happened in my life, and I had no idea what it was other than just the tragedy of the whole thing.
So did you drown it out? Did you drown out the memory?
It burned itself out. Yeah, everybody... and then chemical plant history, for the fire departments, the outside, like Houston Fire Department does not respond, and we don't answer to the police. I don't know if you know that. I didn't know that until then. We answer to OSHA as a chemical plant, as a corporate entity. Even as far as when something like this happens, there's no murder charges filed. There's no manslaughter charges filed. It's under the jurisdiction of OSHA. And when there's a fire like this and an explosion, Houston Fire Department does not respond. There's an organization called CIMA, C-I-M-A, Channel Industries Mutual Aid, where all the other accompanying and surrounding chemical plants hop in the people that are fire trained, like I was, they hop on their fire trucks and they race to the plant that popped, that blew up. And we had 16, 17, 18 trucks there within just a matter of 20 minutes, 30 minutes. This giant fire is going. That whole area was just completely decimated. Everything is black. It's soot. There were 17 bodies in there. They went in and did the first body count, and it just floored me. Some of the leadership that night was gone. John Blackstock was gone. One of the other former that night left the plant. I'm not even going to say his name. I don't want to embarrass him. He ended up turning to be a big hindrance and a big liability. He was the one that demanded that those guys stay past their 16th hour and die. But basically, it was to finish the job, and they didn't even get to finish the job because of this.
Ray, let's see if we can move on to the recovery end of it.
Okay. 14 months after that, my father was murdered. 3 months before he was murdered, he took me to my first meeting. He thought that I had enough snap to know that something was wrong in my life. I'm living at my mom and dad's house. I'm seeing a psychiatrist. This is about almost a year later. I've been drinking heavily, 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 and in the last 3 or 4 months, I've been re-smoking cocaine. It popped back up. Just purely by serendipity, it popped up on a drinking bout, and I took it and jumped right back into that saddle. He took me to my first meeting. He thought that I knew that I had a problem because I'm living at dad's house. I'm seeing a shrink. I've got about $6,000 worth of hot checks out. I'm estranged from my wife and my kids. I'm on leave of absence from my job. My life is a mess. He thought that I saw that. I said, well, what do you want me to go to these meetings with you for, Dad? And he said, well, for your problem, son. I said, I ain't got no problem. Y'all got the problem. If y'all would just leave me alone, there wouldn't be no problem. That's the problem. And I meant that. I really did. But I said, I'll go for you, Pop. And on the way back from our first to second meeting, he said, son, are you hooked? He used that old school terminology. And I was like, I've never thought about it. And I said, maybe, I think, possibly. He said, well, when did you get hooked? And Harold, this is for you. It goes back. And I told him, I said, Pop, I remember blowing out that first hit way back and thinking, this is the one I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I had no idea what was coming. As Bill talks about coming into the program, under the lash of alcoholism, we learned about the fatal nature of our situation. Then and only then do we become as open-minded as willing to conviction and as willing to listen as a dying committee. That was going to happen a lot later. I didn't know that. Was it Cocaine Anonymous? My dad got murdered 14 months after that explosion and a robbery, and the wheels just fell off in my life. I don't even like thinking about this stuff. That's been 23 years ago. And I didn't know it then, and I know it clearly now that I was trying to die. I didn't know that. I just thought I was trying to escape the pain, and that's how I rationalized everything that I did. That job I resigned from, I couldn't go back in there. I had post-traumatic stress disorder. I had nightmares. I would panic. I had panic attacks. I would panic sometimes when I would see a tower up and down. You know, the distillation towers in the plant, like up and down 225. I had shit off of 225. I had nightmares, had bad dreams. My wife and my kids wouldn't see me for days, weeks, a few times, months. My health was deteriorating, and I thought it was just my right. You know, nobody should be able to tell me what to do. I ended up finding out that one of the oldest groups in Houston, Texas, it's right there in that little hometown, Galena Park on the east side of Houston. It's called Industrial Group. And I didn't know that I was being thrust into AA boot camp. Most of the guys there and some of the men, some of the women, there was a couple of women, had all sobered up in the late 50s and the 60s and some in the 70s. And they were real hardcore, rigid about tough love, even though that wasn't a term then that I had heard. They said you help an alcoholic by not shaking his hand, you help him down when he relapses. You help him reach his bottom. They were real rough on me. They used to openly take bets that I would die that month or that year, or that red chip that I picked up wouldn't turn into the yellow chip. I also was exposed to the 24-hour club, which was just a few miles. That particular group, industrial group, was founded in 1950, the 24-hour club in 1955. So by one of the old industrial group members, Tuffy Wright was his name. I didn't know that it was going to be a boot camp. There were some guys I thought were just willfully being very rude and mean to me, telling me to sit down and shut up. I didn't know anything about staying sober, and I'm not going to put in the expletives. Y'all can fill in the blanks. Sit down. You don't know anything about staying sober. If we want to know how to wreck our lives, then we'll ask you to talk. Right? Until then, shut up. And I would argue with them. I learned a little bit of the big book, just so I could correct them when they would leave out the word the or but or and. Hey, you left it out. We would discuss this. I would sit down with these guys. They had 12, 15, 18, 20, 25, 30 years and discuss the finer points of the book. I thought I was such hot stuff. I was nothing, man. I was just a little deal. The reason I know now that they would make these bets and would try it on me and tease me, what I thought was teasing anyway, was they were trying to show me, I know now, how predictable my behavior was. That there had been absolutely no change, no psychic change for sure, no behavior modification, no moral psychology, none of that, that I was just showing up to meet. One of the things that I'm pretty staunch about now, you know, I just use a little analogy. If I go to a welding class, for a year, or a year and a half, or 2 years, and I don't read the welding literature, and I don't let somebody show me how to weld, can I actually, at the end of this course, call myself a welder? No, I cannot. But we will let people come into these rooms, and we do it, and it's part of the third step open arms deal. But people come into these rooms, and this is what I did, come into the rooms, just go to meetings, not really read, study, and apply the literature, and I wouldn't get a sponsor and let anybody take me to anything. And then I was wanting to run around and call myself a sober alcoholic. I put together 26 months in that span, 6 years and 9 months between my first exposure to the program to my sobriety date. That 6 years and 9 months got really bad. I put together 26 months one time. I think 18 months another time. I picked up a 16 chits, I think it was. And on Jack Linskill was one of the guys at the 24-hour club that was I thought he was real adversarial to me. He sobered up in 74 and died in 04. He was tall, slender, smoked more of these long brown, more cigarettes. And 3 or 4 times, I think it was 4 times, maybe 5, I don't know, over the course between 92 and 96, I would get a new chip and I would walk into the 24-hour club. And it was a custom hit for all these old-timers to show up in the morning, get their quick cup of coffee in and out, start their day there at the 24-hour club. Now they have a morning meeting for some of the people that come in, but they didn't then. And Jack was one of these guys that would there most mornings, and 4, maybe 5 times I remember coming in, there'd be just a coffee bar guy, just me and just Jack. And I was a little smart now, a little smart Alex, and I would go get my cup of coffee and sit down in front of Jack, and he would say, "How you doing, Ray?" And I would say, "I'm doing fine, Jack." He would ask me, "How much time we got?" Because he already knew. Everybody knew who was sober, who wasn't. He was picking up new chips, who relapsed. There was a real small society there. And he'd say, "How much time you got?" And I have to take out my 30-day chip and my 60-day chip and my new desire chip. And I'm going to flip it to him across the table, you know, real insolently, just flip it across. And I remember one time it fell on the floor. But he'd pick it up and he'd look at it and he'd say, "What are you going to do?" And I had this tawdry laundry list. "Jack, I'm going to get me a job, get me a girlfriend, get me an apartment, I'm going to get a sponsor, I'm going to go to a meeting every day, I'm going to work the steps," just blah, 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 so much trivial stuff. And he would hand me back my chip all these 4 or 5 times, and he would say, "I hope that works for you."
Kind of arrogant, huh, Ray? That was pretty arrogant of you.
I was a turd, man. I was just awful. Anyway, and this guy, starting, I think, in 93, somewhere around there, he would come and sit down beside me. He started out with $5 bills. He graduated to $10 bills. He graduated to $20 bills, and then to a 50 the last time. He would come sit down with the money opened up in his hand, and he would turn it, palm his hand, palm down on my leg beside me as he's sitting beside me, and he would say, "Rafe, you're just making us miserable. Let me buy you your first drink. Get out of here. We're not mad at you. You just ain't done." And I would get all indignant, full of righteous indignation. "Man, you can't talk to me like that. How dare you tell me to go get drunk? Blah, blah, blah." I didn't understand. I do now. That last time, at 26 months sober, in December 96, he sat down with a $50 bill and said, "Son, you're just killing us. You're making us nervous. You're miserable. We're miserable. You need to go get drunk." And I said the first time, I said, you know what, Jack, you're sure right. And I grabbed that 50 and I ran out. And he stood up. And he was like, wait a minute. He really wanted me to take 50 now. But it started the end. And that was the beginning of the end. I got out there and I went straight down the fifth of Jack Daniels because that's what I always had to have. I took a couple of good hard pulls on that bottle. I'm in my car. And you know what sounded really good after that? Luckily, I had a little bit of money, or maybe unluckily, I had a little bit of money in the bank. I had a car. I had an apartment. I didn't have a house. It was over in Braver Notes. And I just went crazy, dude. I just went crazy. It was time. And I understood what they were talking about, that I needed to get drunk because it felt so good. And it was the relief that I needed. All that anger, all that frustration, the irritation, the aggravation, the exasperation just went right out the window. As the doctor's opinion says, the ease and comfort.
Of that first drink.
Taking
yep.
a few drinks. God. And I remember going to the liquor store and just knowing that I was fixing to be drinking calmed me and made everything okay. It just made everything okay. And I was
thinking about
car
drinking.
Selling
just
cars.
Thinking about drinking.
The relief that I knew was on the way completely was like a sedative. Just the knowledge that it was on the way. I started smoking cocaine almost immediately that day again. The Jack Daniels was always there in a 1/5 bottle form. I would go through a fifth every couple of days or 3 days. Sometimes I might could stretch it for 4 days, and that was just to take the edge off of the cocaine. You know, when it would be long bouts in between of an hour or two. Because I know how to go 12, 15 days in a row with no sleep, no sex, no food, just dope cigarettes and a little bit of water when I remember to drink it. In the summer of 97, that was in December 96 when he did that to me, and when I accepted his plea, or his bargain, I guess, in the summer of 97, something happened. I realized that I'd been out there all this time, 6 or 7 months, and that maybe I needed to stop. And I couldn't. For the first time, all my Alcoholics Anonymous training about the allergy aspect, the mental obsession aspect, it started flooding into my brain. It suddenly became very relevant. It became important. I started trying to stop. I started trying to moderate, and I couldn't. And I realized that everything that those old guys had been telling me, Bill Bonds, Okie Hubbard, Fred Minor, Rick Stucher, Mike Gesfield, Little Joe, Tom Carva, Jimmy Cramer, all these guys that are dead now, all those little things, those little prods, those little pokes that they had been giving me and telling me, it had finally manifested itself in my life, and I couldn't stop. I couldn't even moderate. I remember that I started making the desire chip circuit, as I call it, going to all the clubs in Houston. You know, there's 15, 18, 20 clubs then. And I would pick up a desire chip, and I would try to stay sober, and I just couldn't do it. The most that I got, two times, maybe 3 times, was 3 days. And I just couldn't. I couldn't get far enough away from the last drink and the last drug for the allergy to settle down and allow the mental obsession, the sober mental obsession, to kick in. I couldn't get away from it long enough. I couldn't even get through a full detox. It was horrible. And I became resigned in September, October, November, December, January 98, that the only way I was going to get sober was die. And I got very hopeless. It was about feeding a habit. It was about work. Not work at a job, but it was about work, staying under the influence, keeping that feeling off me, keeping myself in that euphoric state where nothing mattered, and yet I knew that everything mattered. And on 2/24/98, which is my sobriety date, around 3 a.m. in the morning, 3:30, somewhere in there, was February. It was about 25, 30 degrees outside. It's been sleeting. It's cold. I'm in a dope house. I got a fifth of whiskey in my feet. There's no utilities in this house. I've been in there for 3 solid days straight. I've got $800 in my pocket. I just gave the little brother that I've been smoking with $300 and the keys to my car to go get some more dope. And I checked my pulse. And from my calculations then, I was doing about 190 to 200 beats a minute. And that freaked me out, and I thought I miscounted. I took another pull of my whiskey. I counted again on my little pulse checker vein in my wrist, and it was the same. Now, Bill Bonds, back in 92, asked me if I was done one night. I didn't understand. 93. I didn't understand. Because up to that point, I'd been asked if I had had the last drink out of the bottle, if I was willing to go to any length. And I said, God dang, Bill, what does that mean? So he took me to the little side room, and he said, what done means is this, that you drank all you can drink for as long as you can drink without dying, until you're willing to never drink again. And then you come around enough, you learn how to live one day at a time. And I immediately told him I was clueless about what he was talking about. He said, oh, I knew that. I know. You know how we do. When I say I know, well, I don't say that anymore, but back then when I would say I know when someone would tell me something, it's because my pride would not allow me to say I don't know. So instead of saying I don't know, I always said I know. And I spot that in people that mirror me today. So I realized in that night, and it is a significant event in my thinking, I realized after checking my pulse in that cold dope house, with my socks wet from sweat and I'm not cold in about 25 degree weather, I realized in that moment that I was done. I realized that I had drank all I could drink and drugged all I could drug for as long as I could without dying. And I was now willing to never do that again. And I knew without a doubt that I had to come around y'all to learn how to live. I call it the conclusionary trilogy. Step one, two, and three were done in that instant only because I had had prior knowledge of what was expected of me. I admitted and I knew without a doubt that I would die that night if I didn't get out of there. I came to believe that the only power that I needed was the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous in those rooms, and I made a decision to go through with the rest of the steps with all fervor that I could. The guy came back, I got my keys, I left, he kept the dope, I went to a halfway house, I spent 4 months there. The next day, the next evening, I was in Bentop at the urging of the house man there. He knew the charge nurse, she was 16 years older then, I can't think of her name right now. As soon as I walked in, she panicked. I didn't understand why. She shoved me in there, and he tried, and I wouldn't look. I was yellow, and I know that my right side hurt. I was real sick. I was down about 120 pounds, 21 pounds. I was immediately placed in ICU for the span of about 5 days. It was required. My kidneys were supposed to die, and my liver was down to about 30% function. And the sad part is the doctor told me he used some rather crude language that I won't say on this radio show, but he said, you did this to yourself. No one else to blame, and I knew that. It felt unfair, too. I remember that thinking, man, I'm finally going to do something about this, and my kidneys are going to die. Anyway, so I got out. Took me about 6 months to put on about 20 pounds. There's an old-timer that's still around. He's one of those young old-timers. He's still around when he was 19. He's got like 26 years now. And he remembers me back then, and he told me, he said, man, we didn't think you was ever going to get on a yellow. That was kind of a running joke. There's some of those others that are still around that remember. And I got real sick. It took me a year to recoup fully back to my present body weight, about 160, 165. I went to 762 meetings my first year. I counted because I knew that someone was going to need to know that after me, that my determination and my diligence and my vigilance to this program, my commitment to staying sober was there. It was never about to drink that first year, by the way. What it was about I was afraid I was going to miss it. I didn't speak one time at any of those meetings, and I know that I probably forgot to count at least 200 meetings, maybe 300. But 762 is the number that I counted. All I said when I was called on, I never raised my hand with my name is Drake. I'm an alcoholic. 22498 is my sobriety date. I need to listen. And they would pass me over. I did that. I don't know, probably 50 times, maybe 100 times during that year that I was called on. I refused to share because I was afraid I was going to miss it. It was that important. Yeah, I met Tom Flynn around day 20, day 22, somewhere in there. I don't know the exact day. We took the steps in the mid-30s of my days, 33, day 34, 36, something right around there, mid-30s. He said, we did the third step prayer, and I didn't want to get on my knees. I still don't want to do that. But we did it, and he gave me a piece of paper and a pen. He said, right, and kind of real flippantly, I said, how much time I got, 2-3 months? He said, no, you got 2 hours. Anything longer than 2 hours and you're lying. Anyway, so I wrote for a couple of hours. We came back. We talked about it. We went and made some amends. We reviewed page 84, 85, 86, 87, especially page 84, where it tells me to stay in my own thinking by continuing to watch for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear. When these crop up, we have thought it wants to remove them. We discuss them with someone immediately, make amends quickly, resolutely turn talk to someone we can help. And love and talk to both of our code. And what I discovered from all of that, it's kind of I've got what I call racisms, and that's kind of a little arrogant deal, but I got, well, Joseph, you got them too. You make up stuff, so do I.
Sure.
I see some insights in that book, and what that book is addressing, and I don't know how many people have told this to me, even old timers for 15, 20, 30 years, and I see this light going in my eyes like they missed that. How did I miss that? I see the consternation on their face. And I ask people, what's the only problem that Alcoholics Anonymous addresses, or any 12-step program, but we're just going to stay with the A. What's the only problem Alcoholics Anonymous addresses? And they'll go, me, or my drinking, or alcohol, or alcoholism, and I'll shake my head and I'll say, you're guessing. Say you don't know, because obviously you don't. And they'll go, okay, I don't know. Then I'll turn to page 35, and the very first sentence is, so we shall describe some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. Obviously, this is the crux of the problem, and I would very delicately point out that the only problem that Alcoholics Anonymous addresses is my denial-based, self-deceptive thinking when I'm sober that leads to that drink, and that if I take these steps, and that if I can implement these thought patterns into my brain, if I can learn some of that book, actually memorize some things, and have them readily available in my thinking, that I can interrupt the thought processes that normally will take me way right to the cocaine or way left to the Jack Daniels. And that's, as I see this program, that's what it's about. I'm adamant about staying rudimentary with it, especially with a newcomer. I'll ask them, what gets more alcoholics drunk? And I tell them, it's a trick question. This is a trick question. What gets more alcoholics drunk? Is it anger or resentment? Because Bill Wilson tells us we've got to be free of anger. Or is it resentment? Because
it's alcohol.
Yeah, and they'll always go, I don't know, it's both or something like that. And I'm like, no, it's alcohol. That's silly thing. And I watch this flush come over their face, and they laugh, and they get it. And then I'll ask them, what keeps more alcoholics sober? Is it God? Or is it 12 steps? And they'll say both or take their stab at one of those two. I'm like, no, it's not drinking.
No, it's not drinking.
It's not drinking. See, and that's the level that I'm at. I'm a hardcore, big book, black belt, kung fu, AA Nazi thumper. And that's not so that I can be a know-it-all. That's not so I can tell somebody what to do. It's not so I can have soothe my little ego. It's because I have such flawed thinking. And if I don't have this stuff readily available in my thought processes, then, I mean, I'll give an example. If I don't know to avoid retaliation or argument, guess what I'm going to do? I'm going to retaliate, and I'm going to argue. If I don't know that I'm supposed to do the 4-step sick man prayer for that guy, then I'm not going to do that, and I'm going to bite his head off. If I don't know that I'm supposed to continue to look in my own thinking for selfishness, dishonesty, resentment, and fear, then I'm not going to do that. If I don't know that I'm supposed to pause when agitated or doubtful, then I won't do that. And that's why I'm so adamant about the literature, because most of that stuff is foreign. It was revolutionary to me. The fact that someone could actually look at their own thinking instead of running around being that third step actor looking at the whole world at large. You know, at the bottom of page 61, he talks about the retired businessman who lost in the Florida sunshine, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the politician reformers who sure all would be utopia as the rest of the world behaved, the ministers who sighed over the sins of the 20th century. What's the other one? Oh, the outlaw safecracker who's locked up. And then it talks about the alcoholic lost all. The reason that's in there, most people skip right over that paragraph. They have no idea why that's in there when I ask them. The reason that's in there is because Bill Wilson said on the preceding page that most people live by self-propulsion, and he says each person is like the actor once on the whole show. He doesn't say alcoholics. He's referring to society at large. And the reason on page, the bottom page 61, he talks about the reformer and the minister and the politicians and the retired businessman is because those people can live like that. But I can't because I'm allergic to alcohol. Those guys can live like that and think like that and go have a drink or two or not drink at all. I have no problem with that. But I can't. If I live like that, when I'm pointing the finger at everybody, I'm going to get miserable when people retaliate. And a drink's going to sound really good because I have the mental session.
So what do you do now, Rafe? What do you do now to stay in maximum service to God and your fellows? What do you do now? What do you do? What's your action? What do you do?
I go, as my sponsor told me, showed him 79, he said, son, don't ever talk about gratitude. Gratitude is something you display with your feet. And I was like, what are you talking about, Jim? He said, by going to meetings and being helpful to people, trying to help. I average about 15 meetings a week. I go to groups all over the city. People know this mug. One of my friends asked me about 5 or 6 months ago. He said, Ray, how many sponsees you got? I see you were a bunch of guys. And I was like, man, I got like 163. We're on the phone. And he said, God dang. He said, man, he said, how do you manage that? I said, only three of them call me regular, so really no big problem, right? It's not a bad. Come on, man. That's a pretty good joke, Joe. Anyway.
Oh, yeah. Okay. You know what? I didn't catch it at first because I have a bunch, but there's only a very few that ever call me. I never hear from once in a great while somebody will give me a call, but that's the way I set up my program because once I've taken them through and they've made a conscious contact with God and they're sponsoring other guys, there's really not too much that we need to talk about unless there's some accountability that needs to come up. If I did my job as a sponsor and they've made their conscious contact with God, it's really not too much I need to talk to him about.
Right, right. My oldest sponsee that I still mess with is coming up on 9 years. I run into people. I ran into a guy this morning that's got 14 years and just hugged me like I was a long-lost friend, and he just described. I was about a year and a half sober when I met him at the 24-hour club, and he described to me the impact that I had on his life when I would come up there and sit with him for an hour or two or three and run him through that book and clarify stuff for him and assist him. I bought him a couple of packs of cigarettes. I remember that. I'd buy him coffee. Today, I essentially do the same thing, and nothing much has changed, really. I run a small company, a little glass company. I do windshields and stuff like that. I wear all the hats. I'm the buyer, purchaser, phone closer, installer, I do everything, driver. And because I'm around the city to the tune of 150 to 200 miles every day, I get stopped in a lot of AA clubs. I see a lot of people. I still run people through the steps very quickly, a day or two. And they're talking about, I'm stuck on my four step. That's pretty much when I leave them alone. I'm not as rigid as my sponsor is. He will walk up. When somebody asks him to sponsor, they'll look him dead in the eyes. They got 3 days or 3 months or 3 years, and they'll say, have you had your last drink? And depending upon what they say, as you alluded to earlier in the broadcast, I sure hope so, I think so, you'll walk off and say you need to find somebody else. And say,
yeah, they're not ready yet.
And I see that. But I now know that it's really not fair for me to do that to somebody because I've seen people at a year, one guy at 3 years, have the light come on. I'm like, dude, I understand what you're talking about. I'm like, what do you mean? He goes, I'm done. I said, dude, we asked you that 3 years ago. He goes, I know, it's taking me all this time, going to meetings all this time, to realize that I'm done, and I never want to drink again, and I'm willing to do whatever it takes to not drink again. And that's the deal, you know. Practical experience shows that nothing will so much ensure many of them drinking as intensive work with other alcoholics. Doesn't say.
You know, the other one I like, really is in the 12 and 12 on step 5, until we've spoken with complete candor to someone and they've done the same with us, we still didn't belong. Step 5 was the answer. It was the beginning of a true kinship between God and man. So what that's saying is not only do I have to speak a fifth step, I have to hear a fifth step. Who hears a fifth step? A sponsor hears
a fifth step. And I have to give mine away. That's free information before I hear theirs.
Right.
If I'm understanding that correctly, Bill Vaughn, that old guy that I talked about, he showed up in 59, he died in 97. he was very, very dear to me. And I didn't know then how dear he was going to be until he's gone. You know, he took me to lunch once or twice a month. After he saw me walking around with a 12-12. This is probably 93, 94, with a 12-12. And he goes, son, come here. He goes, what are you doing with that book? I said, I'm reading it. He said, no, you misunderstand. He says, why aren't you carrying a big book? I said, I don't know. I hear all these other people talking about the 12-12. He says, no. He says, I'm going to give you a little directive here. He said, listen to me close. He said, you might buy it, you might not. It doesn't matter. But anyway, you're going to know. That is advanced AA that you got in your hand, and that's written by one man. Don't read that book until you got at least 15 years sober and until you have mastered the other book. Well, I'm now 15 and a half years sober, and I still haven't delved much into the 12-12, but I think I might start next year. I don't know. I know there's some
like,
that I hear people talking about, but I'm into the big book.
I hear that, and the big book is sufficient to our ends. But it also says on page 164, this book is only meant to be suggestive. We know so little. More shall be disclosed.
And Bill Russell, he was three and a half years sober. I understand
right,
that. I do, Joseph.
To dismiss the 12 and 12 or to dismiss any good AA literature, I think is ludicrous. You can make up your mind after you read it. At least take a look at it. Before you
I've been to it a couple of times back then.
All right.
Something I was going to say that jumped out of my brain.
Yeah, it just. I think the important thing is to open your mind. You know, they used to do it. If you look on the iconic picture of the man on the bed, there's a painting that was done in 1955. It was a depiction of Bill W., our co-founders, and Dr. Bob going to the hospital. Visiting, you know, like you said, it's probably not a hospital. This is a depiction of a man on the bed. It's supposed to represent, yeah, Bill D. Well, could have been bug juice. Who knows? Maybe that's the way they would.
That's whiskey. It's a bit of whiskey.
Well, they could have been titrating him down. I'm not going. But in the guy's hand, right? There's a book. Now this
right.
is 4 years before. It's depicting a scene 4 years prior to the publication of the big book. What book did they allow in the hospitals back then? There's usually
the
only
Bible.
One, the Bible, yes. And there's one drunk talking to another drunk. So one guy's a doctor who was sober 18 days. Bill W. was sober maybe just about 6 months. And number three, Bill D. was a lawyer. So we had the chief architect. A doctor and a lawyer. So we had a doctor, a lawyer, and an Indian chief. And the important thing to remember is that the most powerful tool we have today is one drunk talking to another.
That's it. That's the deal. And I can't, if I can't understand the path that the bill, I mean, the book is written on the assumption, you know, that assumption is on page 34, that the reader desires to stop. If I don't know that from looking, reading, and studying in this book, then how can I transmit a message? If I'm not done, how can I transmit a message? I'm very enthusiastic about it. You've been around enough to know that I'm very enthusiastic about this program. You know, at the top of page 15, Bill Wilson talks about his wife and I. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping another alcoholic to a solution to problems. And top of page 20 talks about that my very life as the next problem thinker depends on my constant thought of others and how to help meet their needs. Opie Hubbard and Bill Barnes were those two guys, those two old guys that sobered up in the 50s. They died the same year, ironically enough. Were real regimented about that. They didn't know anything really about the book, and it used to kind of puzzle me and freak me out. They'd been around all that time. They said they'd never had a sponsor. They said they'd been best friends this whole time, but each of them knew each other's story. They had never formally taken the 12 steps. And here I am all these years later, almost 20 years later, and here's another one of those rapism pack deals. Here's when I found out that there's only two wrong ways to take the steps, or do this program. Let me say it this way. There's only two wrong ways to do this program. The first one, of course, is obvious to everybody. That should just not do it. The second one is to do it and to think that you did it right. There is no right or wrong. It all the bottom line is to not drink and stay sober and address my sober thinking through the different ways, the myriad ways, during this book. On page 95, just to further support that, it's talking to a guy like me or a guy like you who's working with a drunk. And Bill very bluntly says that he is not interested in your solution. He didn't say the solution because Bill Wilson was clear that there are as many different ways to do this program as there are people in it. I don't do much of the 11 steps. I'm not a ritualistic, religious, superstitious guy. I'm just not. I don't see the necessity for that, so I don't. But I do see the necessity, the absolute necessity, of examining my own thoughts, my own motives, stopping interrupting the processes, the thought processes, and carrying this message to people who need and want it badly, as Dr. Bob said on page, bottom of page 18.
Let me give you this on step 11. Prayer is the quarterback, meditation is the feedback, and self-examination is the goal line.
Right.
The unexamined life is not worth living, and a life in recovery is to die for.
I agree. Rich says words. The part of the 11th step that I do is I meditate quite frequently, 3, 4, 5, 6 times a week. It's important to me to do that by myself, in my room, all alone, with no distractions.
Sure.
And to catch my thoughts and to bring them back. And all I meditate on, quite frankly, is just compassion. That's something that I don't have. I also am a full-blown Asperger's. For those of you who don't know what that is, that's mild autism. I'm a really high-functioning autistic, but I'm still a low-functioning normal.
Socially, you got a challenge, but I know you're kind of a brilliant guy when it comes to memory and
right.
application. So, Harold, any last words before we need to close it up?
Yeah, we've got about 4 minutes. I've really enjoyed the program, and I really appreciate the focus on working with others and the focus on working out of the book. We need to study the book and study the recovery literature, and that's what's really made a difference for me. All I can do is tell you my experience, strength, and hope, and I appreciate both of you for doing tonight. I think it's been a great program. I hope there's value from our program. Thank you, everybody. God bless you.
Thank you. Well, thank you so much, Ray.
Yeah, and I'd like to say one quick hello to somebody out there that I grew up with who's in this program, Denise Gerson. I love you, Denise. Take care, baby. And thank you, Joseph, for having me on.
You're welcome. Thank you for helping out last minute like that, Rafe. That was very good
Not
of
a
you.
Problem.
Thank you so much.
Not a problem. You're welcome.
In closing, I'd like to say rumradio.org. We're in 151 foreign countries, including Mississippi. About 350,000 hits to the website. Matter of fact, we're very popular in Nepal. Did you know that, Rafe?
No, I didn't. Who would have guessed, right?
You know why? They like our yak. No, we really are in Nepal.
So I believe that you're worldwide, you're on the internet.
Yeah, it's worldwide. We're in about 2,800 town, cities, and villages. If you need some solid sponsorship information, some really good stories, it's all program, it's humorous, and it's spiritual. So remember, the next time you're looking for some good information, just turn it. No money is being made, and we're anonymous to the 11 tradition. And remember, we'll see you on the radio, rumradio.org. Good night.
Good night.
Good night.